You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial radio in New York City, WBAI, in New York. And it's 10 p.m. Next, we hear Every Woman's Space.
Sister woman, sister, can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your vein? Sister woman, sister, have the walls grown up so high that you can't even dream of leaving and you've forgotten how to fly?
Hi, I'm Irene Yarrow, and this is Every Woman's Space.
Away a child and they locked her up in some juvenile hall to grow up weary and wild. Oh, sister woman, sister, they won't let me come and see you no more, but I still got the poem that you wrote.
If you listened last week, you heard the first program of this series, and you know what Every Woman's Space is all about. Just in case you didn't, if you were away on vacation, or, as I was, maybe in Philadelphia demonstrating, or maybe if you were watching the boats, I think I'd like to say a few words about what Every Woman's Space is about. It's a program for all women. It's about women in the arts, women in politics, about our relationships. It's a personal program for, by, and about women. It's also a political program. The emphasis in the program is on interchange and communication, a lot of ways, between me and the guests that I have on, and then between us and you out there. It's really important to me that you take the time to write letters, maybe entries from your diaries or poems, anything that the programs you hear make you feel. If you could send parts of them to me here, I would be very, very happy to have them. Any kind of input, suggestions, criticisms, and then on some shows, we'll be taking phone calls. This is one of them. Later on in the show, we'll be taking phone calls from women. Just to finish up, I want to quote the folio copy on this show. I want this to be a space for all women, lesbian and straight, well-known and not known, of differing racial and ethnic groups, ages, and classes, to be together, to talk, to listen, to share, and to grow. My guest tonight is Carol Rosenthal, a professor of English who has published many short stories, essays, and criticism. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Irene.
Carol's also an old friend, and I'm really, really glad to have her on my second show because it happens to be the first one I'm doing live, and I feel very supported having her here. We've been women friends for a long time.
A really long time.
How many years?
I think we've been friends since 1969, 1970, but I knew your work. I knew your writing for several years.
And I knew yours.
Yes, it was
right.
Really strange.
Right. And, we've had very different lives. We've grown in very different ways since we've known each other, and we've remained really good friends and enjoyed each other's work. And tonight, we're going to be reading some of it on the show. We're going to be playing a tape that we made earlier in the week where we read some of our story. We each read one story, and we do a lot of talking about the issues contained in the stories, and then we'll be back on live again and taking phone calls from women who have anything to say about anything they've heard, the issues, the stories, us, the program, anything at all. Once again, before we put the tape on, the first voice that you'll hear will be Carol Rosenthal reading her story, Cowboys.
Cowboys. I turn off the television and sit, watching the luminous spot in the center of the set grow smaller. Then, still holding a can of Diet Pepsi, I lean over, pressing my nose to the window screen, and watch the shadowed people of the city walk through the gray and hazy summer streets. The heavy air flickers. A thin rain is falling through it. I blink, and behind my darkened lids, test patterns jump. Poor reception. Getting static. My husband buzzes his electric shaver in the bathroom. I'm getting impatient. Hurry, Robert, I yell. It's beginning to rain. We're taking a walk this afternoon because our air conditioner's on the blink, and our apartment's particularly oppressive. Ready? Robert calls, coming into the living room with a blue towel tossed across his shoulder. Ready, I reply. He grabs a shirt hanging on the knob of the door, and I grab my pocketbook, and we both say goodbye to the cat. Then we start down the damp, echoing, but very clean, marble steps and go out into the street. New York streets smell in summer. Odors packing together like foam rubber, stuffing up the front of your nose and expanding. Both Robert and I are breathing through our mouths. First, we hold hands for about a block, but soon that feels clammy. We're sticking to each other. Then we drop our arms to our sides, where they barely move at all, as if encased and protected from their own thrust by the padding of the heavy air. Robert, I call to him, let's begin to play. He can hardly hear me, a red truck passing makes so much noise. What should we play today, he asks. How about cowboys? That's my favorite game, but sometimes he only wants to play his own game. He slaps his pants and finds his gun and says, okay, and then, I'm Tim Holt. He's dead, I say, grazing him with my hip as I sidestep to avoid a pile of dog glue. Be someone alive. I'm Tim Holt, he repeats emphatically. Robert's several years older than I am, obviously, and he likes to show off things I couldn't possibly know about. Our fight is beginning earlier today. I give in. Okay, I'm Roy Rogers. You're Dale Evans, he says, pulling his gun out of his pants and getting a draw on me, right in front of two old Polish men sitting on their stoop in sky-blue peekaboo nylon shirts. You're a cowgirl. No fair, I cry. I want to be a cowboy, too. Despite the gray air and drizzle, there are a lot of people out on the street, and I have to keep angling my body so they don't bump into me. You're a cowgirl, Robert insists. You have to be. I'm not, I say, wishing I had not left my gun at home, tucked beneath the mauve cushions on our Danish modern sofa. Sometimes I tuck it into my underpants beneath the skirt of my dress before we go out on walks, and I'd pull it out right now and click its yellow plastic handle and shoot Robert dead. He can be so frustrating sometimes, always wanting his own way. He expects me to be content with my dolls, those vapid pink flesh dolls that stand in the bookcase, 22 of them, and I never want to play with them. I'll only play if I can be a cowboy, too. Okay, then we won't play today. A slow yawn is on his face, but he's just covering up a smile, emotional blackmail. We just won't play if you won't play right, he says. Okay, I say, stretching. Also yawning. But it's no good, because he knows that I really do want to play. I don't care if we play or not. It's not fair that I always have to be the cowgirl and you the cowboy. It's not fair at all. I never get to go any place with you. You're always riding the range and protecting the camp and yodeling and roping the horses and herding the cows and playing the guitar and shooting down Indians and rounding up rustlers, and all I ever get to do is nurse those lousy dolls. He shrugs. We're standing, waiting for the light to change, watching number 5 buses pulling up at the corner and letting off all their passengers. Pressure gathers in my stomach. Let me be a cowboy, I cry. Let me have some fun. Oh, Robert, let me be a cowboy. He stands for a long time, scuffing his foot on the curb, looking intently at the traffic light. Oh, please, let me be a cowboy, I say, big tears gathering in my eyes. Will you? Will you? Well, okay. My relief's enormous. 2 passersby stop and look at me as the tears rush down my cheeks. Sometimes Robert can be so nice. I rub my fist into the corner of my eye. Bang! I turn around quickly. Bang, bang, Robert says. You're dead. I see that Robert has gotten the draw on me. He's attacked me, and he's gotten me right in the heart. I stop, almost in the middle of the street. A taxi almost gets me, too, screeching its brakes, the driver yelling at me. Robert pulls me to the curb. I got you already, he says. The game's over. Let's go home. You only wounded me, I say in a faltering voice. It's just a superficial shoulder wound. I am staggering, my hand pressed to my heart. Nah, he says, spitting on the sidewalk. I really got you. You're dead. Let's go home. Wounded, I shout. Dead, he repeats. And I begin crying and crying. scratching sound that hurts my stomach and grates up through my chest and out my mouth. There are no gritty tears this time, but my eyes sting horribly, and inside my head is the kind of a high, thin sound a television makes when it first goes on. And I'm very dizzy. Wounded, please, wounded. Robert's afraid that I'm making a scene, but I don't think anyone is really paying any attention to me. You only wounded me, I whimper. Shh, turn down the volume, he hisses. Please, please, oh, please, please, pretty please with sugar on it. He's embarrassed. I'll buy you good humor, he says, stopping before a uniformed man with a cart who barely glances up at my painfully contorted body. Okay? Oh, can it be over already? Please say I'm only wounded, Robert. You're really dead, he answers, studying the chart of flavors on the cart's side. But I'll say you're only wounded if you'll shut up. You're so damn mean, I shout. And for a moment, everyone on the sidewalk, businessmen, beggars, housewives, winos, hippies, shopkeepers, students, mothers, dogs, and alley cats, all look at Robert. He pretends not to notice, but I can tell he's uncomfortable. He turns to me and reaches for my shoulder. I back away. Are you really wounded, he asks. Shall I ride you to a doctor? He tries to examine my shoulder and lower, but when his fingers are on me, I get dizzy with fright. For 1 second, he and the good humor man and all the people standing watching dissolve into a series of frenetic horizontal lines, and I hear static in my head, crackling and popping right in my ears. Then I push him back. I fight my way through the damp air, through the people, and run back down the street, through traffic, across intersections. I reach our building and open the door downstairs, up the steps and through the high-ceilinged halls, and scrambling for the keys, I get into the apartment where, rushing to the window, I can see Robert running after me. I know he'll be at the door any minute. Shall I bar it? With what? A chair would slip too easily. I could hurl the weight of my body against the door, but it would never work. It runs through my mind that maybe I should pretend to be dead, so that when he crosses the threshold, he'll see me lying there and leave me alone. Or maybe he'll take care of me, cradling me against him, making soft cooing sounds to me. I do crawl around on my hands and knees for a second, searching for a suitable place to die. But then, just as I hear his footsteps coming quick and stark against the polished marble, I leap from my position and run to the couch, where I snatch my red plastic gun with its yellow trigger from its hiding place. He opens the door. I shoot him. He falls to the ground, eyes rising, and red shiny blood forms shapely plastic pools on the floor. Then it spreads thin. He doesn't even cry. He just gazes at me, eyelids blinking, his hair hanging over his forehead. I fall against his chest on top of him so that the blood seeps through my dress and over my body, too. Then I roll over, and we're lying next to each other. I grab at his hand. We hug, clutching each other. Will we ever have children, I ask? Never, he says, and dies.
Wow. Carol, I love that story.
Great.
It's incredibly powerful. I love the play between fantasy and reality that goes on through the whole thing.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you're real people and you're people on a TV screen. I love the fact that you're children and you're adults. How do you feel about it after? You wrote it about 5 or 6 years ago?
No, I wrote it longer.
More?
Than
10?
No, 1968. When I wrote it, I didn't know what it was about. It was before of the women's movement was current at all, and,
uh-huh.
and in fact, although there were the beginnings of it, and certainly, as you can tell from the story, I was feeling things that have since become...
The feminism that was inside
that's
all
right.
of us before
that's
we
right.
became feminists.
Right, but it hadn't been mapped out yet.
No.
But the thing about this was I didn't know what it was about when I finished it.
Well, listening to it now with a lot of sophistication, some of the themes in the story are really, really clear. It's a lot about
oh,
roles.
Oh, yes.
The thing that's striking about the story is that he determines. He says what to do. The female character in the story
right.
cries and says, oh, please, 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 can I be alive? And he stands there and thinks about it and looks around and says, no, you're dead. And he has all the power.
Yeah.
And you don't question it. The female character in the story
yeah,
doesn't
right.
stand there and look back at him equally strongly and say, no, I'm alive. you know, I'm alive, you didn't get me, and the game has just begun, and we're going to play. Instead, you say, oh, please, please, let me be alive. And the female role of crying and begging and the male role of determining what's going to happen is real strong in this story.
Oh, incredibly so. But I think another interesting characteristic here is that the woman in the story, who is much more self-conscious about her childishness here, she is much more aware of the fact that she's playing a role
right.
in a certain way than the male character, is actually so overcome with anger out of her perception that this really is a life and death struggle.
The interplay between fantasy and reality is very, very strong.
Well, I think that the ultimate sterility of their condition, not just the fact that they kill each other,
mm-hmm.
which in a certain sense they literally, within the universe of the story, they literally kill each
mm-hmm.
other.
Mm-hmm.
But the question at the end of the story, will we ever have children? I mean, she's deluding herself. Having shot him, she is deluding herself to believe that there is still a possibility that this relationship can be anything but sterile.
Oh, they're playing a very frightening game.
Aren't they? Well, it's a game that's very recognizable now, I think, to us. Mm-hmm. And again, I think not just in male-female relationships, but the kinds of power pulls that strike us in a very infantile
mm-hmm.
kind of place.
There's one line in the story where she comes into the apartment and for a moment she feels a need for him to come in there and take care of her.
Oh, yeah.
Look, she is furious with him. He has taken all the power, and she runs away, and she goes in the house, and she's furious and wants to kill him, but there's an overpowering desire on her part to have it all be nice and have him come in and hug her and stroke her and make it all better again.
And also, I think she thinks that if she really does appear to be mortally wounded in some kind of way,
you feel sorry for her.
Yes, he's going to take care of her.
Yeah.
He's going to cradle her, and he's going to coo to her.
Right. If you were to write that story now, would you write it any differently?
I would say that in a certain sense, I mean, that story is a very old story, that I've been mm-hmm. rewriting that story thematically in many of the stories
mm-hmm.
that I write. I'm particularly interested in what I would call a kind of vertical writing, a kind of dipping down into that primary process
mm-hmm.
kind of area where our really, really deeply narcissistic and infantile selves clash right up against the game of being adults that we are involved with. I had been writing for all my life, actually,
mm-hmm.
and had on and off received tremendous encouragement, but also I had been discouraged from time to time, and I was particularly discouraged whenever I seemed to veer away from the traditional
concept. Forms of writing.
Exactly. And so I began writing stories that I recognized had certain commercial values, because I felt if I could sell them, then I would get that feedback as a writer,
mm-hmm.
and I would be a writer, and after
right.
all, wasn't that what I wanted to be?
Right.
But in fact, that wasn't feeding me, although I was publishing the stories, it wasn't feeding me in another kind of way. And I began writing these kinds of stories that were vertical in the sense that they were just dives into a kind of internalized universe, although they're certainly plotted. And this is the second story of that series.
Did you encounter any differences in being able to publish these pieces?
Oh, are you kidding?
I know, that was like
of
a loaded
course.
One of the things that we wanted to be sure to talk about
yeah.
today was how hard it is for women writing today, writing about women's issues, to publish them, because most of the people who run magazines are men.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a lot of trouble publishing stories that are about our internal realities, because our internal realities don't have too much meaning to male editors.
Even our external realities don't have that much meaning.
That's right. That's right.
When I finished writing this story, what happened was that I sent that story out to one place. They wrote back that it was a very interesting story, but not suitable for publication. You know, what are your standard kinds of rejections? And so I literally shelved the story. I never took another look at it until
mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Irene and I were in a writer's group together, mm-hmm. a woman's writer's group.
10 of us, and we met for about 2 years, once a week, right?
Right. The first time I ever read in that writer's group, which was terrifying to me because the whole idea of being public is frightening in a certain
uh-huh.
way, and especially
uh-huh.
being public about your most private
right.
thoughts,
right.
the things you write about, right?
Right?
I brought a story to that writer's group that was very realistic, and I read that story, and I was waiting for reactions, and I got pretty good reactions. And Irene pulled Cowboys, the one I just read, out of her purse, and she said, "Carol writes experimental fiction, too. I think you should hear this." And I myself
had
not...
I remember doing that.
Yes, I swear to you, it's true. It's true. And I hadn't looked at that story in such a long time. And everybody recognized what it was about, and I recognized suddenly what it was about.
And that it was a story.
That it was a story, and that it was very obvious. In fact, I began to think, my God, is it too obvious? Have we already over-talked what this is about?
You had essentially devalued the story.
Very much so, but I think I've had a tendency to do that about the pieces that meant the most to me.
Oh, that's really interesting. On last week's show, we talked about a lot of different things. It was a sort of a general program about feminism and how things haven't changed in 200 years. But one of the things that we kept talking about is how women consistently devalue themselves and devalue their work, and how society devalues work that women do. And we pick it up. It is very hard for us to break out of a lifetime of conditioning. And so that story, which, hearing it now, it's inconceivable to me that you wouldn't have recognized it as something really special that you had produced. And yet you put it away in your file after it had been rejected once. And
yeah,
well,
once.
Maybe
isn't
it was
amazing.
Right. Maybe it really wasn't a good story. And it's very, very fine. Anyway, tell the story about the rejection. Because
oh, yeah.
I want you to say
said. Right. Okay. So having discovered the story again, I decided, okay, I'll send the story out. And so I sent it to a magazine whose name I won't mention, got back a very lovely rejection letter in which I was told this story has very clear detail and it's has charm and appeal or whatever. Oh, and I had this phrase in it, and sometimes you hear this from editors, it's so frustrating. And I'm sure this story will find
a home somewhere else.
Somewhere else, right. But we are forced to reject this because it becomes apparent, after all, that the issues here are trivial. And that killed me.
That's what I wanted you to tell
that
people.
That killed me because
right.
I thought, gee, if there's one thing that this is not...
is trivial.
It's not trivial. To the extent that our fantasy life is trivial, it's trivial. But in fact, our fantasies, articulated or not, activate the realities that we create.
They also express what our reality is, what the
okay.
reality of how we okay. live our lives, experience our lives, are expressed through our dreams, our fantasies, and our stories.
Okay, they're a metaphor for our reality, but even more importantly to me is the fact that they create our realities. The manner in which we experience something
mm-hmm.
creates how we will act in the situation. So here they are, for instance, in this story, playing a game. And the game is deadly.
Also, what happens when, over and over again, editors of magazines and publishers of books reject women's writings on the grounds of its being trivial, it doesn't just make it impossible for we women writers to publish the material that we feel it's very important to communicate to other women, but those other women, the readers of these magazines, don't get to read women writers expressing what may be partially their realities, too. I had a very interesting experience with this about 3 years ago when I made a radical change in my lifestyle from being a married woman of 13 years to coming out and becoming a lesbian. I was asked by the editor of yet another very well-known periodical here in New York to write an essay on what it was like to change lifestyles. He really wanted me to do this, and he thought it would be wonderful for the women readers and men readers of his magazine to find out what it was like. And I said, fantastic. And I sat down and I worked for 2 months. And I produced what I thought was a very meaningful piece of writing. I was really happy with it. And when I sent it to him, he rejected it. And he rejected it on the grounds. What he said, I could quote, is, "Your piece does not have enough emotion in it," unquote, which was so
that is totally incredible.
Ludicrous, because it was a very, very emotional piece. There was no way that I could talk about that enormous change mm-hmm. in my life without doing it on an emotional level. And he rejected it. By so doing, he threw away my 2 months of work because the piece wasn't published. And he also deprived, I don't know the circulation of this magazine, but it has a large circulation, so he deprived maybe, 50,000 women of reading this. He didn't succeed, though, because it was published subsequently in the Amazon Quarterly and in the Lesbian Reader, and it's been republished other places, too. But if I hadn't gone on to women's sources, to sources of publication that women are creating, no one would have gotten to read that piece, and he would have had the power to deprive women of sharing my woman's experience.
You know, what I think is interesting, though, is that I don't think that the people who are in this kind of editorial capacity are doing this as part of a conscious conspiracy, although sometimes I think it is, actually. But more frequently, I think that they really, truly believe the things that they're saying.
They believe that these are trivial issues.
Or trivial, or emotional in the sense of hysterical, as opposed to deep human emotion.
But I feel that that's because they have to feel that way, because they're invested in the system as it stands. And if they were to give a lot of credence to women's experience, that would make us too important?
Well, I think it's more complex than that. I just got through reading a book that hasn't come out yet by Andrea Dworkin called Our Blood, and she quotes the 20th century poet Theodore Rothke on the subject of women artists in that book, and it's really amazing. He talks about how women are unable to experience real agonies of the spirit, how they're limited in range. They don't have a sense of humor, that we've heard about, you know, a million times. Mm. But essentially, there seems to be a real belief that women cannot experience the, quote, really important things in the world. And I think this reflects the fact that women and men do have a different culture. We have a shared culture, and we bow to the belief, or have bowed in the past to the belief, that the real world, the, quote, universal world, the world of universal truths and universal realities, is the world that's been defined and created by men.
As far as they're concerned, the reality is the male reality.
But I don't think we've begun to explore what the female reality is.
And we have begun to explore it, and we have begun to express it and write it and paint it and make plays about it, but our problem isn't getting those things out.
And getting them recognized, I think that it's not just a problem for men to recognize them, but for women to recognize them, too, because we're
Which brings us back to the devaluing.
Right, because we're exploring entirely new territory. That's why, incidentally, I'm interested in writing about the internal life, because I really think that it's in our internal life that we're going to find a different and a rich new culture, a female culture.
Our strength, I think our pain, I think our struggle, and I think our strength. And I think they all have to be able to be expressed.
Yes, I think that also.
I'm going to read a short story that I wrote called Mother. Mother. You know there are hundreds of skin cells she has scratched off over the years. She's 59. She has them all in jars, labeled, on the shelves, just like ginger or asafran, except these say things like right index finger and abdomen and scalp. And they are in washed-out jars, not new jars. The handwritten labels are attractive, lined alphabetically on the shelf. She loves taking care of them and spends a great deal of time printing and gluing and labeling. Sometimes. Sometimes she erases everything about them from her consciousness and does more likely things, such as watching TV, or she puts on music and reads the paper. She is working, too, on a plan to remove and collect other body parts. She thinks of nerve cells some of the time, and she started saving extra jars and covers for when she finds out how to get them off. Her brother died of leukemia when she was 7 and he was 9, and she believes this is why she collects cells all the time. She was a Girl Scout for many years. In fact, she started as Little Brownie just when Donnie died, and never stopped. She was a Girl Scout and a Wing Scout, and went on to lead her own troop, and went on again to speak all around the city about scouting. This was from when Donnie died until Wayne was born, her son. It was as early as when they took her off to the maternity with Wayne that she started it. Instead of screaming with the pain, instead she took all her nails off down below each quick, and she filled the little paper hospital cup with them. The last thing she said to the nurse before they put her out was, "Save these." The nurse screwed up her face and dumped them, bits of blood on the edges, dried, in the disposal, and when Mother came out of the ether, retching and retching, she looked all around for the nails, and not seeing them, panicked so that they had to put her out again. In a way, she is like a moth. She doesn't have very long arms. In fact, they are short and stubby, and she usually wears severe suits and dresses that have no flow of cloth to them that would suggest wings. But her complexion is more or less colorless and at the same time translucent, and the lines etched on her face, particularly her forehead, for as long as I can remember, are very insect-like. And it seems to me a moth comes to mind whenever mother comes to mind. Not difficult to understand, given her state of unbalance. She did badly raising her children. Wayne developed asthma and wheezed all the time. He was allergic, and as he grew up, he had serious acne. Mother always told me to comb my hair, and she kept saying, stand up straight, but that was all she ever did. I don't think it helped. There are hundreds of women like her. She's still like this today. She had numerous operations. Once when she went in for an operation, a Catholic woman gave her a holy medal to keep, told her it would help. My mother kept this in her hand, clenched so tightly that the surgeon just said to forget it. Even with the ether, she didn't let go. It was a medal of one sort or another, and mother, of course, was a Jew. She was half German and half Austrian, and her one lovely feature was the Austrian mouth, the Viennese mouth, that seemed ready to crack a whip across your face at the same time as it pursed for a kiss. She had numerous operations, and each time expected she would die, and each time did not. Every time she went in for an operation, it was to a Catholic hospital, and every time it was the summertime, and every time I was sent to Girl Scout camp and Wayne to Boy Scout camp, and every time on the visiting Sunday no one would come. I don't know what Wayne did, but I would sit on the outhouse seat, and I would sit there until all the other parents had come and they had gone. I would just sit there, except when I would spread my legs and look between them to see the green ammoniated water floating underneath, looking for the bits of excreta. Patterns are frightening. Mother had a skin rash on her hand, and she loved it. The only thing to help it was the penicillin cream at $10 a 1-ounce tube, and she was allergic to soap, too, and bathed with oatmeal flakes.